Well, Friday mornings at 8 on the Joy Cardine program is reserved for the Week in Review. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday. This hour, we'll take a look back at the week's top stories from a couple of different political perspectives and from yours at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org or on Facebook. And remember, we have our Week in Review quiz with almost valuable prizes. My guests on the Week in Review this week, Eugene Kane, columnist and blogger from Milwaukee. His writings appear on Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Ken Benversi, freelance writer and blogger who used to work at the Heritage Foundation, served in the George W. Bush administration, and worked on several state Republican campaigns. Welcome and good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, John.
President Obama, fresh off his State of the Union address, spent a little time in Wisconsin to focus on job training programs. He toured a General Electric plant in Waukesha and directed Vice President Joe Biden to lead a government-wide review of federal programs. Eugene Kane, what kind of job training do you think is needed?
Well, I think I always hear about in the Milwaukee area, I always hear about a lack of qualified workers and technicians for certain jobs. So clearly, I think if you're going to do job training, you should be training people for the jobs that are most available and the jobs that are basically put out the signal that they can't find qualified workers in their areas. So there are certainly thousands upon thousands of workers in Milwaukee who could fill these jobs. And if the only thing keeping it from them is training, that's certainly a piece that can be handled by government.
Ken Benversi?
Well, it's Kevin John, actually.
I'm sorry, Kevin.
That's not a problem. actually, I think this is the one area that appears to be there is a lot of consensus between President Obama and Governor Walker. Both seem to be wanting to see kind of return to apprenticeships, a lot of, kind of return to, I guess, what would, the dirty jobs mentality, the old show that was on Learning Channel for a while, trade jobs, things like that. That the idea that not everybody needs to go to college. I don't know if you'll ever see that spoken from a liberal president, but jobs such as welding, things like that are tech colleges and community colleges are doing.
Well, he did kind of throw art history majors under the bus a little bit. I don't know if you caught his remark. He suggested maybe people could go to school and get something that would be a little more attractive in the workforce. And some people weren't too happy about that, but I digress. You're listening to the Week in Review on the Joy Cardine program. You can join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org. Or find us on Facebook, look for the Joy Cardine program. Kevin, what do you think of the president's focus on job training? I know you said that's where he and Governor Walker might agree, but we'll talk more later about Governor Walker and Mary Burke as they run for governor. But what do you think, Kevin, of Mary Burke not traveling to see Obama? Is that a big deal?
Well, I guess in this stage of the campaign, you would qualify it as a slight not big deal, but in the fact that the national narrative of Democrats who are literally running as far and as fast as they can from this White House, it definitely is a big deal. As my bio tells you, I've worked on a couple of statewide campaigns. I actually wrote a piece yesterday on advance teams and how just the way politics works. There's no way they didn't know this was coming, so the entire too busy excuse is laughable on its face. They knew this was coming. They pretty much made a political calculation. They don't want pictures of her standing or near the president out there at this point in the campaign, which, given the poll numbers, 70% of Wisconsinites have no idea who she is. You would think any FaceTime would be a good thing for her at this point in the campaign.
Eugene Kane, should Mary Burke have ventured out to take shake President Obama's hand, or does it really not matter? And if not, why not?
Well, I think just judging from the reaction of people in Milwaukee, particularly African Americans who've been looking for some kind of sign to introduce them to Mary Burke, I think it hurt simply because he's still very, very popular in Democratic and African-American voting circles. And one of the things they're looking at in this governor's race is some sign that their vote is valued, that that people will listen to their concerns. And for some reason, people understand that Obama won Wisconsin and that and he's done it twice in the presidential elections. So it's hard to really see the next Democratic candidate for governor acting like Obama is not someone that can help her. And when she – and I do think – I agree that it is a political consideration by Burke's people not to meet with Obama. And that just sends a disheartening sign to some voters who I think don't buy into the hype that Obama is such an unpopular president that you – if you're a candidate, you can't be seen standing next to him. I think in a lot of areas, Obama is that whole card that you need to play in 2014.
And she did call, she did talk to him on the phone, though. I mean, does that matter?
Well, I mean, if she's going to call him on the phone, why couldn't, you know, they arrange something more substantial than that, at least, a photo op or something.
Sure. And President Obama gave his State of the Union address this week. Eugene Cain, before we get into details about what he had to say, how would you describe the state of the nation?
Oh, me personally?
Yeah.
No, I mean, we're doing the best we can, I guess. That's essentially the way I see America at this point in time. There's a lot of challenges, a lot of things still not really working as well as people want them to, but I don't see any necessarily dark foreboding cloud of despair headed our way. So I think, you know, America's doing the best it can these days.
Kevin?
I guess the best way I would put it is one giant holding pattern. Nobody really knows what's going to happen when it comes to regulation. Nobody really knows just how the healthcare law is going to affect them in 2014, especially in bigger employers who were exempt from the exchanges last year but are looking at that in their face on coming September and October. Nobody knows what some of the bank regulations that are supposed to come in are going to do. So it's a lot of uncertainty, which you would think 5-6 years into a presidency should not be there.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And the Joy Cardine program is easily discovered on Facebook. You can leave your comment or question there. Again, 800-642-1234. Kevin, President Obama says he's willing to work with Congress, but that he'll sidestep lawmakers whenever and wherever necessary to reduce the income gap between rich and poor. What do you think of that approach?
Well, he does have executive order power. The real question is what can he do with it? I mean, the biggest headline before the State of the Union was he increased the minimum wage on federal contractors. I used to work out in D.C. I knew more than my fair share of federal contractors during that time. I knew not one of them that was pulling down minimum wage. So I don't know who and what that applies to, and they keep saying, well, these are the guys who work the cafeteria. One of my jobs was to help redesign a cafeteria at the HUD building, so I never knew guys there, even the guys who were flinging fries, making, you know, minimum wage, and especially in D.C. So in terms of constitutional power, I mean, again, it's just one. I think some of the concerns of conservatives and Tea Party groups are a little overblown, especially as with executive powers. The executive orders, they only last as long as the president who's in office. And then in the next president coming and decide, do I want to keep this or not, and then scrub it. I mean, we've been seeing this for years with the Mexican City policy over abortions. When Republicans in power, it's back in effect. When Democrats in power, it's gone. So, I mean, the only thing that really kind of worries you is this is a guy who was a senator, was a constitutional scholar for 10 years, as he told us many times on the campaign trail, and seems to have just utter contempt for the separation of powers and the fact that he does actually have to work with Congress.
Eugene, is this a strategy you would support, bypassing Congress to get things done, especially to raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 for contract workers?
Well, usually you don't want to see a president taking such bold action, although I noticed once again with Obama, people are trying to paint it as though he's the only president who has ever had this kind of power. And, of course, everyone has, and in recent years, a lot of presidents did the same thing for various causes. But I will go along with the idea that, particularly after last year, when this obstructionist group of Republicans shut down the government and just basically showed a disdain for government, I mean, I think it was a bold move to announce that we're not going to let this small group of maverick politicians take over things anymore. And if I can find a way to bypass this, because clearly there are members of this Congress that will never work with this president. So, I mean, I did like it, because I'm one of those people who thinks Obama should have been tougher on a lot of the people who've been blocking his agenda. And this is a very small component. I mean, the federal contractors with minimum wage is probably not a lot of them. So I agree with the guest said it probably doesn't really reverberate that much, but it does send a message to the larger issue of raising the minimum wage. And I think that's really what he wanted to do by mentioning it in his State of the Union address. He's looking to get more traction going on raising the federal minimum wage for everybody. And yeah, I do agree with that.
The president also called on Congress to pass immigration reform this year. Eugene Kane, is that going to happen?
I doubt if it'll happen this year, but I think the conversations are starting, and as you get closer even to presidential elections, I mean, the Latino vote is going to play a huge part in that. And so far, Republicans have been shooting themselves in the foot in terms of their relationships with minorities, African Americans and Latino Americans. So it'll be interesting to see if on immigration, at least, Republicans who have just been so intent on blocking anything that Obama offers, it'll be interesting to see what they do with an eye towards impacting their own voting totals in parts of the country where Latinos do control a large part of the vote.
Kevin Beneversi?
Well, I think it's really going to be a question of how the negotiations of compromise go and who decides what is a big plan and what's a little plan. I'm actually more of a fan of kind of this piecemeal approach. I mean, anyone who actually does look at our immigration laws tells you these things are a mess. I mean, the visas alone, I mean, I'm talking just regular legal visas. You know, if you are a foreign national, you come to America to work here because you have a job, it is a complete and utter, you know, foobar from day one till the day you finally get your green card. And those things do need to be modernized and corrected. But I'm not a fan of seeing this what would be, you know, blanket amnesty or anything else like that, because part of it and also the problem is we don't know what the heck's going to come out of here. And you also seem to have, especially with just the past negotiations with the White House, be it debt ceilings, be it budget deals, the less the president gets involved, the better the deal seems to be for both sides, which is just, I don't know if it's a sign of his negotiation skills or his ability to pick up the phone and actually call everyone. He says he has a pen. He says he has a phone. Let's see him actually use it. Or if it's, you know, heaven forbid, considering he comes off as a goofball, Joe Biden actually doing something as vice president.
The House passed a nearly $100 billion a year compromise farm bill earlier this week that makes cuts to food stamps and continues subsidies for farmers. The Senate is expected to take it up and pass it next week. The president has indicated that he will sign it. Kevin, do you think this is good news?
I side with the Washington Post editorial board and veto the thing. It is an abomination to anything that is known as U.S. farming. There's actually a really good breakdown at the Washington Post. I have a great pie chart. I advise your listeners to look at it, where it actually breaks down percentage-wise what is in the farm bill. 79% of this is food stamp and nutrition. It has nothing to do with farming, crop insurance, and then you have the parts that actually do deal with agriculture. The large bulk of it is going to subsidies for quote-unquote, you know, for guys who aren't actually farmers but technically qualify because they're growing peanuts or something like that.
Eugene?
Well, I think most of what I hear about the farm bill is concern about the cut in food stamps because, again,
it's $8.5 billion over 10 years, Eugene, just to clarify the number.
And I think the people who are concerned about that also look at the farm bill as not necessarily a misnomer, but almost like a camouflage for what's actually happening. Because one of the things people suggest is that in what the category of what's known as a U.S. farmer, that might be one of the big entitlements in this country that have that became sort of like bad guys during the presidential election with Romney and his takers and maker 47%. And people are concerned why American farmers somehow always avoid that sort of label of being taking something from the government they don't really deserve, and it gets wrapped in something like a farm bill that, again, isn't really about farming at all. I agree with that. It's more about these food stamps that people are concerned about.
And for the record, Representatives Reed Ribble, Paul Ryan, Sean Duffy, and Tom Petri voted yes on the farm bill. Representatives Jim Sensenbrenner, Ron Kind, Mark Pocan, and Gwen Moore voted no. So Wisconsin's congressional delegation split on the farm bill, but it is expected to pass the Senate, and the president is expected to sign it, despite what the Washington Post editorial board may want him to do. We'll have more talk about the farm bill and the State of the Union coming up after 9 on Point on this radio station. Right now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll move our week in review on to state issues, and there are plenty of those. We're talking about the news stories of the week on Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. You can join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find us on Facebook. And remember, still to come, our famous Week in Review quiz. You won't want to miss that. When we come back, I want to talk about the announcement this past week of the retirement of a GOP moderate in the state Senate, Dale Schultz. We'll talk about that and more on the Week in Review when we return. My guests are Eugene Kane, a columnist and blogger from Milwaukee, whose writings appear on Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Kevin Beneversi, a freelance writer and blogger who formerly worked for the Heritage Foundation, served in the George W. Bush administration, and worked on several state Republican campaigns. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When you hear that music, you know it's the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday. Kevin Beneversi and Eugene Kane are with me talking about the week's top stories. In Wisconsin, one of the big stories this week was the announcement, although I don't think it was a huge surprise, the announcement by Dale Schultz that he's not going to run for re-election. Schultz, of course, definitely a moderate in the GOP, and has taken a number of votes that weren't too popular with the rest of his party in the state Senate, sometimes siding with Democrats on some issues. Kevin Beneversi, let's start with you. Was Dale Schultz retiring because he was just tired of it all, or was he retiring because he faced a primary challenge he didn't think he could meet?
I think probably it was a combination of both. I mean, he's been in legislature now almost 32 years, so I mean, he's no spring chicken anymore. Secondly, the thinking was, if he was going to try to maintain his state senate seat, he was probably going to run as an independent. He had just up with number, as you said, with the number of his votes, he had upset a lot of his local GOP parties. And then thirdly, the other sign that it probably wasn't going to happen was apparently his fundraising was not doing too great, especially compared to his likely primary opponent, State Representative Howard Markland. I'm sorry, Markland. And so it wasn't seen as a shock as much as it was just kind of, I think he may have been doing it just so he could beat the headlines of people quickly going into the GAB database and seeing how much he raised money this time around.
Well, Kevin, before I have Eugene respond, is this a sign that there's just really no room for moderates in the Republican Party in Wisconsin?
No, I mean, I could turn that around, especially, and I could use my own family as an example. I mean, my cousin is former state representative Bob Ligabar, who, let's be frank with ourselves, was the last conservative Democrat in Wisconsin. And for years, he had primary challenges from his left for his state assembly seat in Manitowoc. And, you know, and it's really a question is moderation even tolerated among either party? I mean, I can recall reading in 2006 the lovely press release from now Congressman, then State Representative Mark Pocan, saying no money will go to Bob Ligabar because you know, Bob Ziegelbauer had the audacity to endorse John Gard for Congress. So, I mean, it's more of a question of, are we kind of really strapping down on team loyalty, you could say, maybe. But also, there is a generational thing here. A lot of the younger, newer Republicans in the state legislature are much more conservative, much more focused on tightening the state government, making sure every dollar counts. And Schultz is of that era. I mean, I think I recall he was almost in the same legislative class as Tommy Thompson back in the day, of a lot of, you know, kind of free spending Republicans.
Eugene Kane, what did you think of Dale Schultz's announcement?
When a longtime politician decides to hang it up, that doesn't register that much with me, because I think politics needs to be reinfused every couple decades or so. I think whenever a Republican in Madison basically leaves the stage, what Milwaukee voters, Democratic voters in Milwaukee, wonder is, will it help break, you know, the stranglehold Republicans have on a legislature right now? And I don't think it will, regardless of who replaces this guy. It will probably be another Republican. I understand the word moderate for him is probably appropriate. He voted against Act 10, which is about, he's the only Republican I couldn't think of that did that, and that probably got him a little bit of favor from Democrats for being moderate. But in the end, what good did it do? I mean, it really didn't do any good, because Act 10 passed anyway. So to answer your question, it doesn't really register that much with me. I don't necessarily think every time a politician retires, that's not necessarily a bad thing or a reason to get alarmed.
In addition, by the way, to Markline, Democrat Ernie Whitwer is also running for Dale Schultz's Senate seat. We'll have Dale Schultz on this network on Monday morning during the State Capitol Report after 7:30, and we'll get to hear from him about his retirement. Okay, there's a new poll this week from the Marquette University Law School. It shows 51% of those surveyed in Wisconsin approved of the job Governor Walker is doing, and 42% disapprove. And Walker has also extended his lead over Mary Burke to a 47-41% margin. Eugene Kane, what do you read into these poll results?
Well, I think the real big news when the first poll came out, Marquette poll, was how close Burke and Walker were. At that time, I think it might have been 47-45%. Now with this one, Walker's lead has widened, and even though I've talked to some Milwaukee Democrats who say, oh, it's still too early, and are very heartened still by the fact that nobody knows Burke, but she's still polling very close to the allegedly very popular Wisconsin governor. My sense is that there, unless she really starts her campaign, I remember looking at these polls in previous races, and it's hard to make up the distance once it's been established. And a lot of people are disheartened because they don't really see an urgency from Mary Burke to address this close. She's close now, but people kind of accept the fact that unless she really kickstarts things, the lead is going to continue to dissipate or get wider.
Kevin, the governor's percentages haven't gone up. Burke's have gone down. How do you interpret the growing lead for the governor over his challenger?
Well, I think you would say there's definitely ceilings and floors for Walker. I mean, there's little doubt he is such a poll after, especially after Act 10 and the recall and all the protests. He's a polarizing figure. I think it's probably, as Eugene was saying, you're having a lot of Democrats looking at the Burke campaign and going, what are they doing? Campaigns are about narrative and momentum, and what you're seeing right now, good or bad, her skipping out on the Obama thing adds to narrative, creates momentum, you know, shifts, you know, gives people ideas of, are these guys actually fighting or not? So therein lies the real question. I mean, what are you going to see from the Burke campaign to actually show, other than we have a bunch of ex-Obama staffers with us in allegedly deep pockets, you know, any life from it?
A new analysis by the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau says the average taxpayer who owns a home will save $177 under Governor Walker's property and income tax proposal. The memo released Tuesday comes as lawmakers continue to digest Walker's $504 million tax cut plan, which he unveiled last week in his State of the State speech. Kevin Beneversi, we'll start with you. What about these tax cuts? Some are saying we should be paying our bills instead of cutting taxes by this amount. What did you think of what the governor did and what's happened since?
Well, I think in this case, I mean, you have, you know, at least signs that the state economy is growing. I mean, I don't buy a lot of the talk about the, you know, structural deficit, because it's structural deficit is a false narrative unto itself, because the idea is it's a snapshot in time, and then you take that the mechanics of a snapshot on day one and apply the math of day one and apply it to day 300. The problem is no one knows what day 300 is going to be, so they have to apply something to it, so thus you get this giant hole. In reality, the economy is growing, jobs are being created, tax revenue is being collected. So I don't buy those arguments. I think, you know, it's a start. I think it's, you know, there's Wisconsin is still a tax hell. It's something that we still need to worry about, and especially in terms of drawing jobs away from and making ourselves other states and making ourselves more attractive to, you know, other than climates in Minnesota or Chicago or the Chicagoland area, because that's where, you know, is our always our biggest competitors.
Eugene Cain, what do you make of these tax cut numbers from the Fiscal Bureau?
I think understanding what Governor Walker is doing is easy to see that he wants Wisconsin taxpayers to know that he's going to save them, homeowners to know he's going to save them $177. And, I mean, nobody wants to talk light of that amount during these days, tough economic times. But the bottom line is $177 a household is not all that much money to sort of turn anybody's prospects around. Using that money to reduce other costs and expenses in government, and even to restore, I mean, there are a lot of people who think Governor Walker has cut too much, and there are a lot of programs that could use some of that money. So even the media is complicit when we always report, well, everybody average is going to save $177, and it looks good until you start pulling it apart and realizing, okay, people are doing bad in this state, but still, $177 a household, that's not really all that much money. It's pretty much what he's doing for his own elected, the governor, I mean. He puts that number out there so now he can continue his reelection plans and further election plans to paint himself as a savior who goes in and brings back money for the average, you know, Wisconsin homeowner. And it's really sort of like smoke and mirrors to me.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. What did you think about the governor's tax cut proposals? 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can find the Joy Cardine program on Facebook as well and leave your comment or question there. You might want to talk about Dale Schultz or the gubernatorial race, which appears now as though it will be Governor Walker and Mary Burke, since there is really no longer any Democratic challenger that's still in the race. And that's all fodder for our discussion here on The Week in Review, 800-642-1234. Now, there isn't any guarantee that these tax cuts are going to sail through the legislature unscathed. Senate Republicans are concerned about increasing the state's projected budget shortfall. And so there is some question about whether this even will survive in the legislature. Eugene?
Well, it's always encouraging to see that Walker can't just, you know, put a rubber stamp on things and have it sail through. So, again, to me, the question is, what do they propose to do with the money as opposed to giving it back to people in attack in some sort of tax cut?
Kevin, there appear to be some Senate Republicans who think the structural deficit is a big deal. Do you think there's enough support in the Senate for these tax cuts to go through?
I think there's probably enough support to maybe get you 75-80% of the tax cuts. I you know, there's it's always the same 2 to 3 state senators. It's going to be, you know, Mike Ellis, Robert Coles, probably Luther Olson, who are the ones talking about structural deficits. I think you'll see, you know, 100 million or so of the projected surplus probably re-thrown into, you know, then, you know, added into the rainy day fund or whatever it is, just to probably appease them. So I think at the end of the day, I still think the tax cuts, you won't get the initial proposal probably through, but you'll probably get some sort of modified version of it.
Let's take a call from John in Grand Rapids. John, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, I thought it would be kind of nice, but I pretty much expect it'll never happen, that the governor could talk a little bit more about how that budget was balanced and the sacrifices that public employees made. And by the way, he told me my house taxes or my property taxes would go down. And when I paid them last July, they told me they went up $200. So I'm actually in the hole with this tax cut, I guess, and that doesn't go well with me. And I'm kind of still waiting for the jobs promise that he made to see him make some progress with that and quit blaming people besides himself for his lack of progress in that respect.
John, thanks so much for that call. Kevin, how about if you respond to that first and then Eugene?
Well, he said, you know, the reforms we enacted, that's you know, indicator to Act 10. I mean, he's in Grand Chute, that's correct myself if I'm wrong, the Appleton area. So it's a question of who's actually using the reforms or not, or who did quick end arounds Act 10 to try to, you know, do these. I mean, there were little pockets, and then of the state where, you know, property taxes did go up because, you know, they just ran around the end reforms and just did what they always did, which is we're just going to jack everybody's taxes, property taxes. Then you add in the tech colleges who are accountable to no one and who have a free rein to pretty much raise their rates any way they want. So, I mean, that's my view, my take on this. You know, there are no reforms, and I don't see these things response. As for the jobs, I find it always interesting when it comes to the jobs issue from Democrats that they act like Wisconsin lives in an economic bubble and that we are not affected by the national climate. I think, you know, Walker and his team are doing the best they can in what is probably a tough economic situation out there. Lord knows, I think we've all felt it. I, for one, I'll admit, you know, in 2010, I was not a fan, and I told people privately about of the jobs pledge because it was just completely, you know, larcical to put that number out there with the economy in as much certainty as it was in 2010. So that's my take on it.
Eugene?
Well, in reference to the caller, I will say that I hear the same from people in Milwaukee that I don't think Walker gives enough due to the sacrifice made by all the public and union employees who basically suffered under Act 10. And, you know, they basically, a lot of the accomplishments that he touts were made on the back of these employees. And the jobs number is clearly, he has hung his own campaign on that. So nobody feels sorry for him as it becomes more apparent that he's not going to be able to meet that number. But at the same time, I think people don't really understand why, when it becomes convenient for Walker, he can tout Wisconsin's economic situation and job situation as improving, but yet always tie it into nationally and blame Obama or Obamacare for why there aren't any jobs. I mean, you can only play that game for so long, but I think eventually Walker will either have to, you know, accept the fact that what happens in Wisconsin under his administration is basically not self-contained in his state. It always is impacted by national trends and what's happening nationally. But then he needs to stop, you know, harping on the fact that, well, I'm doing all I can, but Obama's not doing what he can. So I think people see through that after a while. So bottom line, the job number is still valid to criticize him about.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Jim in Delavan next. Jim, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, fellas. The tax trickle down, I think the perspective has got to be broadened a little bit. that money goes back into the economy. It doesn't necessarily go under somebody's mattress and, you know, disintegrates. So if I get a $177 tax cut, I'm going to go down and buy a set of tires or go to the landscaping store and spend that money. It goes back into the economy. That money gets respent. So I think there's got to be some credit given here to, you know, tax cuts instead of saying, hey, we can't pay ourselves enough money because we're holding these offices and have these union jobs. This money is going back to the economy, and it's a good thing for the state and for the nation. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jim, thanks for the call. Eugene, we'll start with you and then Kevin.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with him, but I think, again, I think when you tout it as though it's going to be a game changer for people during tough economic times, I don't really accept that.
Kevin?
Well, I think the caller is right when he says there's this mentality, especially among those in government, who think it's that tax dollars are their money. And the reality is no, it's our money that we, you know, legally have to pay them, you know, for the rights of citizenship. But, you know, if you have more money brought in than what you thought was going to happen and you're running a surplus, you know, you should get it back. And that's the meme, the talking point, and probably, you know, the campaign rhetoric going forward of Walker and legislative Republicans.
We're talking about the issues in the state of Wisconsin on the Week in Review. Lots of stuff going on, lots of people calling and wanting to join us. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have the week in Review quiz, and we'll continue our discussion with our two guests, Eugene Kane and Kevin Biniversi. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's the Week in Review on the Joy Cardine program. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Joy will be back on Monday. My two guests on the Week in Review this week, Kevin Biniversi, freelance writer and blogger, used to work at the Heritage Foundation, served in the George W. Bush administration, and worked on several state Republican campaigns. Eugene Kane is a columnist and blogger from Milwaukee whose writings appear on Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There was a public hearing on a bill that would allow a 7-day work week. Is that a good idea, Kevin?
Well, I admit, you know, being the grandson of a dairy farmer, I find the entire concept of there not being a 7-day work week kind of laughable. But, you know, I admit I didn't even know this was the law in Wisconsin until I heard about this earlier this week. I've worked past summers in union shops, nonetheless, where I've done 7 days a week, sometimes with overtime, depending on, you know, just what needed to get done. So, I mean, maybe it's just my mentality and just the way I grew up, but I just find this entire argument kind of weird to be or happened in the first place.
Eugene?
Well, I admit I didn't have that much knowledge that you couldn't work 7 days a week. I mean, even as a younger man with various jobs, I worked 7 days a week all the time. It was in another state. That was back in my home state of Pennsylvania. But I never really thought that if you wanted to work more, I'm not sure why an employer would deny that if he had to work for you. So it kind of cut me unawares. Because I saw one of the authors was Glenn Grossman, I had to sort of look at it skeptically because I just don't really think that particular legislator brings any real sincere thoughts or intentions to the legislation he proposes. Sometimes it's more like shock value stuff. So once I saw his name, it seemed, you know, at first I thought it was a kind of kooky proposition, but then it made sense when I saw that Glenn Grossman was one of the ones who sponsored it. I really just don't think, to answer your question, I don't think it's that important because unless you find actual cases where companies are refusing to let workers work extra hours if they have the work for them.
Well, actually, just to clarify, it is current state law that you need to get 24 hours off in any given 7-day period, 24 consecutive hours off in a given day seven-day period. That's current state law. I said I was going to do the quiz and then completely spaced it. So let's do that quickly, and then will take up some other legislation that's being proposed in the state of Wisconsin. So here's your quiz question this week. Milwaukee police are trying to crack the case of a stolen violin, possibly worth $6 million. It was reportedly taken Monday night from the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra concertmaster violinist during an armed robbery. What kind of violin was it? And you get bonus points if you can name the model. What kind of violin was stolen? You get bonus points if you can name the model. So give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We will pick a random winner from among all the correct answers. And then the winner will receive a valuable piece of what we call WPR swag, and we'll reveal the answer and the winner at the end of the program. Okay, so parents, teachers, and doctors are joining together to support a bill that would require elementary students in Wisconsin to get at least half an hour of daily physical education. The Assembly Children and Families Committee held a hearing Wednesday on the bill introduced by Republican Representative Chad Weininger of Green Bay. Current law requires physical education 3 times a week for an unspecified amount of time. The daily gym class requirement was dropped in the late 1980s. Weininger's bill would apply to students in kindergarten through 5th grade. Eugene Kane, how do you feel about 30 minutes of gym class each day?
No, I don't have any problems with it. I think it could solve or it could start to address problems with childhood obesity, or really just address the general problems with young people today being so removed from physical activity because a lot of them are on social media all the time. So unless there's going to be some abuse of it, and you also have to consider there are some kids who I don't think are in a situation where they can actually do that, or every school should look at it differently, I think. But I don't have any real problems with it.
Kevin?
I don't have any real problems with it either. I know Chad Weininger, good guy. Talk to him about it. I mean, this is one of these things where, unfortunately, the culture has made it necessary. I mean, we used to have, you know, in my household, Lord knows, when summer came around, Dad would, you know, wind us, look at all of us on the couch, slam the door, or slam the knob on the TV and go, outside, now. We don't have that anymore. Everyone's glued to an Xbox. Everyone's glued to a PlayStation or whatever. I mean, as Eugene said, everyone's on social media and, you know, their laptops or their iPhones or whatever. So, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, you got to get a government mandate there, but, you know, what else are you going to do, I guess?
Meanwhile, the chairman of the Wisconsin State Senate Education Committee has canceled a planned vote on a bill that would force poor-performing public schools to close or reopen as charter school. Republican Senator Luther Olson said Wednesday he does not have the votes in committee to pass the bill that reworks the school report card to give schools letter grades and incorporate students attending private schools using taxpayer-funded vouchers. Olson says he does not know if the bill will return this year. Kevin, what do you think about that?
Well, I think since I'm a fan of school choice and this felt like an end around to kind of go after the voucher program. Good news. I mean, Luther Olson has never been known to be, you know, an all-out advocate for school choice, and, you know, is usually seen, especially on the Joint Finance Committee, as one of the few Republican friends of WEAC. So I think on that end, it was, you know, good news that, you know, died a slow death.
Eugene Kane?
Well, I'm always wary whenever legislature starts meddling with Milwaukee public schools in particular. I mean, it's weird to have all this emphasis on penalizing Wisconsin public schools or Milwaukee public schools for poor performance. And then, you know, a voucher school like the one in Milwaukee that just sort of closed in the middle of the night recently and left all of its students out in the lurch, students and parents out in the lurch because suddenly their voucher school was closed without any warning the next day. It's weird to me that legislatures don't come up with some way to penalize that type of school instead of always looking for ways to penalize Milwaukee public schools.
And Eugene, as long as we have you, let's talk a little bit about the court decision, which just came out yesterday, I believe it was, that invalidated the residency requirement, going back to something the legislature did last year. What did you think about that decision?
Well, I was glad the city appealed it because, I mean, I really doubt, I can understand there are all kind of different opinions on residency and requiring people to live in the if you're a public employee, to live in a place that pays your salary and makes your money. But there are too many examples. I mean, if anybody knows someone from Detroit, I mean, it's become a bugaboo to always mention that town, that city, in terms of the deterioration that happened once city residency rules were revoked or removed. And it's not, that's not fiction. That's the way it happens. I mean, in Milwaukee, you can tell from even talking to people that if they were not tied to live in the city of Milwaukee for their jobs, they would not do it. And then it raises a question of, in a city where there's always already problems with foreclosures and income disparity, what kind of city are we really looking to create? I hope, because this Milwaukee is a special case, that this ruling will be appealed and we'll be able to keep a residency requirement.
Kevin, quickly, where do you stand on residency requirements? Should we have them or not?
I think they're bad public policy. I mean, people should have the freedom to live where they want to live. I mean, I understand the concerns of, especially among, you know, public safety employees such as fire and paramedic, where you do need that quick response time, but I mean, you shouldn't have to. I mean, I think the one case that's definitely pending in one of the appeals is a guy gets married and his wife lives in like Oak Creek or something, and he's like, you know, well, now we're trapped because if I, you know, I go live with, you know, we go live together in Oak Creek, then I got to go quit my job, and you know, he's got to go job hunting, and it's incredibly stupid. So it's just bad policy.
All right. Well, we're about out of time, and hang on a second. We're going to reveal. We should have a drum roll or some maybe a kind of a flourishy trumpet thing to do to announce the our quiz winner and the answer to our quiz. First of all, congratulations to our quiz winner, Mark in Appleton, who will receive a very valuable piece of Wisconsin Public Radio merchandise. So it's time to reveal the answer to our Week in Review quiz. Congratulations to Mark and Appleton for winning. We asked what kind of violin was stolen during an armed robbery in Milwaukee this week, and the answer is it was a Stradivarius. It's described as a 1715 Lipinski model that was on loan to the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra concertmaster violinist. The man was apparently tased outside Wisconsin Lutheran College following a performance and dropped the case. Police say a man and woman picked it up and sped off in a minivan. Only a few hundred original Stradivarii are believed to exist today. This particular one is estimated to be worth about $6 million. Quickly, Kevin, what did you think when you heard this story?
It feels like most of the caper movies and TV shows I've ever heard, because you're hearing talk about, you know, they need to find someone to fence it, and there's no way they can sell it in the open market. Yeah. It's kind of that intrigue going on in my head.
But a minivan as a getaway vehicle, no style points there at all. Yeah, Eugene, can you get the last word very quickly?
On the violin caper, I hear that George Clooney and Brad Pitt were sighted in the area.
Okay.
They have the Chinese guy who could, like, you know,
yeah,
himself.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Eugene Kane, Kevin Beneversi, thanks for being my guests on Week in Review this morning. I really appreciate it. Bill Martin's produced this hour, directed it, and Robin Cherry handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.